Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
He has folded before under this sort of pressure. The one in Northern Ireland, I remember, at Royal Port Rush, he didn't even make the cut. What are your thoughts on Rory right now?
Tony, far be it for me to ever tell you, the most accomplished person I know in this business, how to start an interview, but I have never in 100 years with you started an Open Championship interview without you asking about the hotel situation.
I'm going to get to that. I just thought we'd get Rory out of the way.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
By the way, from John DeWald to John DeWald, good afternoon. I've watched or listened for years now. I look forward to each and every TK show and PTI episode. This email is more of a service announcement to you and your team than one intended to be read on the air. Those you read all seem to be written by English majors with fantastic senses of humor. Having spent nearly 40 years in corporate America, I feel pretty good about my writing capabilities. I'm also told I'm funny. Nonetheless, Steve Sands was staying at a 19-property UK chain called Malmaison, with locations from Aberdeen to York. My wife and I have been fortunate enough to attend a few Open Championships over the past, two decades, and each time have stayed at one in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Oxford. Should you ever have the opportunity to lodge at one, I would highly recommend it. Heads up, it's not inexpensive, and yes, I know that's a double negative. But it's apparently great, as Sands said it was great.
Yeah, Sandy was...
The pictures are beautiful.
Yeah. We are whole. You hear Michael's voice. We are whole. Michael is back. Why don't you tell us where you were and how you liked it?
Despite the weather in Grand Rapids yesterday afternoon, we made it back safely with the three boys. We were visiting Lake Michigan, the towards the southern tip of Lake Michigan, below South Haven in the Covert area, which there's a family cottage that Liz's family has been going to since she was a little kid. And she really wanted to take our three boys there to experience what she had as a little girl growing up with her family. So took the boys out to the beach, got them into very calm lake waters. That water was warm, and got to play a little bit of golf at the back end. But it was a very nice, relaxing week. Though the highlight for me, I'll get to the golf at some point, we found an iPad app which lets the boys color. And it gives you sort of a grid. You can paint by numbers type of thing. You can use your finger to fill in the different animals. And the boys had been fighting about who would get to sit on the window seat. And Henry got the window seat and wanted to shut the window so his big brother Walker could not look out. Bootsy was not happy about this.
Right.
Liz and I are sitting behind him holding the captain. And at one point before the flight takes off, we see him scribbling because now he can write. And he fills in his little little picture and he writes in a six-year-old's hand, Henry is... the worst. W-U-R-S-T.
Worst, yeah.
Henry's the worst.
That's great. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So you did get to play golf a couple of times. Where did you play?
We got to play golf. So we started, we're in the South Haven area. So we started at just a local course called South Hawk, which had really nice greens. I got to play nine holes with my mother-in-law, Moni, and that was great. We then got to go down to Benton Harbor. Chan, Moni, and I played 18 holes at Point of Woods, which is just a very traditional, old-school, big tree, difficult, undulating greens, country club golf course. It used to hold the Western Am. So there's great history on that course, and it is sneaky hard, even when you play the appropriate tees. There's just a couple of long par fours that are hard to make par on. And then we finished with a great round down at the Dunes Club in New Buffalo, which is a course that I have talked about years before, and we have an emailer, Tom Dorr from Chicago, who has sort of always brought that back up. He is friends with the Kaiser family who helped build this property, and it's a nine-hole golf course that's has one glimpse towards the lake, but it was a great way to save roughly 90 acres of parkland, and it has the some people say it has that Pine Valley feel of these open waste expanse areas, but it's a really interesting model where you have nine holes, but it feels like this huge 18-hole property because they'll change the cups on you after you play nine. And then there's so many different tee boxes. I think it's very much in the match play model. You can go through and have just completely different angles and playing quarters into these holes. So, after that great email we had about one of our listeners playing Crystal Downs and going up to play the Kingsley Club up north in Michigan, I reached out to Tom Dorr, and he was able to set this up.
That's so good. That's
great. I got to play with his dad and one of his good friends, EJ Jones, and
that's so great.
A reminder that golf, when you get out and you have no expectations, can just be a wonderful walk through a park.
It's just wonderful. It leads us into the British Open. We are in day two of the British Open. It's 8:00 Eastern right now, which means it is 1 o'clock in England, where they are playing this at Royal Liverpool in Hoylake. And have you ever played that?
I did not play that course on my trips.
Okay. So, because it's 5 hours later, you know, half of the people are out there now, if not more than half of the people are out there. Probably a quarter of the people are done by now.
Quarter are done, yeah.
Yeah, they're done. I will just say this. It's in flux, but Steve Sands the other day picked four people. He said this was a course you needed to be patient on. He didn't pick any bombers. He didn't pick Rory. He picked the following four people. Colin Morikawa, Ricky Fowler, Tyrrell
Hatton,
Tyrrell Hatton, and Tommy Fleetwood. And Tommy Fleetwood went to bed last night with the lead. He does not, as I am talking, he doesn't have the lead now. He's not out yet. He's not out yet. The lead now is Brian Harman. If Brian Harman wins this thing, I will tell you that he won it on number 12 today when he chipped in for par. Because I thought he was looking at double bogey. But that kept him at 8 under. He is 3 shots up on the field. Right now as I speak, he's 3 shots up on the field. Michael, what you have seen and what you know of the course, what are your thoughts about Royal Liverpool? Because you were telling me before we went on the air, it's an easy course to putt.
Well, I would say generally all of the open courses are easier to putt in terms of 3-putt avoidance. And if you are somebody who sort of worries about that part of your game, it means you can really feast on those mid-range birdie putts. You can be a little bit more aggressive with them, and you're not worried about those 4 to 6 footers coming back like you would at Augusta or a traditional U.S. Open course. I would say from day one, aside from the amateur that you had stealing the show on the beach, just ripping a large bucket of balls into the Irish Sea.
I saw that guy.
It's the story of these two amateurs who I think stole the opening round. Christo Lamprecht, the kid who plays at Georgia Tech.
Were you aware of him?
Eight.
He's huge.
I was aware of him just because he won the amateur. Big guy. He won their amateur. Not too long ago, and he just stands out. So he's been all over social media, and you look at the ball speed that he's able to create. It's the sort of the polar opposite. You look at Rory, who is this very contained 5'8", 5'9" frame, who's getting into the mid-180s, and this kid's touching 190 to 200 if he wants to, but he doesn't need it on this course. And then also the local kid, you have Matthew Jordan, who hit the opening tee shot, and you just see what a course, an open course, means to the community, and you have that extend down to Tommy Fleetwood. And in terms of patience, you have, of course, everyone's talking about the finish. They reworked the 17th to basically make it a Instagrammable and memorable par 3. But that also means that
there's a par 5 at the end.
There are what you'd consider unfair runoffs, where hopefully it doesn't come to that, where a well-struck shot runs off and leads to a double or triple bogey. You had all sorts of players doing the standard putting out of a, putting away from a sod face wall to then hit it backwards. And then you have 18, which is a gettable par 5, but some of those players you mentioned, like Ricky Fowler, struggled on it. Phil struggled on it. JT struggled on it.
He shot a 9.
Internal out of bounds. One of the worst phrases in golf.
Yeah, he shot a 9. It was unbelievable. He's plus 11. Well, he was plus 11. Yeah, he's out.
He's had a tough go in the last couple months.
So,
but he had a great time at Wimbledon.
My feeling about this is, and I have no idea who's going to win. Max Homa is down, as I'm speaking, to -4. Rory McIlroy, I think, is...
It's 2 under now.
Yeah, but I think he just bogeyed a hole, I think. But
he's had some really good par saves, but he's also done the, absent-minded miss a 2-footer.
Well, the par save at 18 that I actually watched with you yesterday.
Tremendous. So this is what I want to get to. As Nigel and I were watching this, there's nothing in the United States that I have ever seen, maybe you have, Michael, that resembles the bunkers at the British Open. Not the one, yes, the ones right around the hole, but the ones on the fairway too. John Rahm is, in my mind, the best golfer in the world. John Rahm twice yesterday had to go out backwards.
If you're a cameraman,
that's a two-shot penalty.
Stay out of his way.
That's a two-shot penalty. You have to go out backwards. Both Rahm and Rory had this unfortunate... The shots they hit look like good shots. They begin to roll a little too much, and they end up in the actual face of the bunker. Rory, on 18 yesterday, couldn't get out the first time trying to go out sideways. then did that thing that we've seen Tiger do with the left leg, left leg out and the right leg down.
Don't
and
rip
he
your pants.
Got out. He got out and he made the putt, which was a remarkable par save to keep him.
I think it was even.
Even or, one or plus one or whatever it was.
Even. Yeah.
I think if you were plus three yesterday, you're in trouble for winning. Rahm was plus three yesterday. Dustin Johnson was plus three yesterday. But Michael, how they're so deep and they're so small. How do you get out of I would just throw it out with my hand.
And you would. And if you were playing, you know, just a random weekend game with me, you would pick the ball up. But this is one reason why you have, you know, more flexible games. You have foursomes. You have people playing what you would call alternate shot because you just have to accept what Lynx Golf gives to you. And you look at these, the layers, and it just reminds you of the layers of 150 plus years of golfing history, where you think about how does a bunker come to be?
And they're giant holes,
right? You just think of, oh, is that where you know, an animal was taking refuge from a sea breeze 200 years ago before you were playing golf there?
They're giant holes. I was taking up divots.
You get a bunker.
I was under the impression for years that some of them actually were created by the bombing of England in World War II.
Yeah, they look like bomb craters.
You cannot get out.
More than that, they have tremendous names for their bunkers.
Why don't we have those here? I guess because they're awful and nobody wants them.
So American golfers tend to have this idea of fairness when it comes to golf, and the golf course has to be deemed fair. You look at greens, the design of greens. You know, you get a lot of issue if there's split levels and little pockets. It's unfair, and that's the same thing with bunkers.
You've played in some of the courses that are in what they call the Rota of the British Open. You played Royal St. George's. You played...
Birkdale.
Royal Birkdale. Did they also have these bunkers?
Yes, and it's entirely wind-dependent on some days. And if you look at... if we come back to the old course and you think you had what was a reversible course, you have some bunkers, you're like, that bunker doesn't look like it's in play at all. And you go, oh, that's because you'd be playing it from the opposite direction. And if you get into that, you really cannot play.
Yeah. It's... Wilbon was complaining that the weather wasn't terrible.
Well, you're always one squall away from the course completely changing.
20-mile-an-hour wind. it was bright, but it was 20-mile-an-hour wind. Enough people by the end of the rounds were bundled up to indicate to me it was probably going down to the 50s.
Well, they're used to that southern Florida weather.
Yeah. But
this is why in 2006, Tiger did not hit a single wood. He hit a stinger 4-iron off every tee.
Because he didn't want to
avoid the bunkers.
Yeah. This is Sands' whole point. Be patient.
Yeah.
Be careful. Be smart. But even these were good shots they hit. They just rolled too much. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is how you have to accept golf. I mean, golf's a game of misses.
Yeah. So anyway, so everybody's out on the course now, I think. I think Lamprecht's out on the course now on one or something like that. It's going to go for a while. The next time we talk about it is going to be Monday morning.
Yeah.
When I think it'll be over.
Yeah, potentially.
I mean, I hope it'll be over at that point. I don't really know. But it's always great to see because the courses look so different. Now, there are some American-type courses there, like Sunningdale, right, is an American-type course.
It's more parkland, so it... Parts of it would look familiar to you, but no, it's not. It's not like anything you've seen, particularly the new course, which is bounded by nothing but gorse.
Can you explain when people talk about a Lynx course, what that means, and do we have them in America?
We don't really have it here. Think about the remainder land that would connect, say, a little town on the sea to the actual water, and think about everything that is in between that in terms of the sandy soil and the type of vegetation that is growing from that. And you had this this piece of Lynx property. And then you go back into the parkland setting where you're sort of carving a golf course out of the trees. And that could still be on top of sandy-based soil, but it's not going to have that sort of straight-out-to-the-ocean look that you're thinking of.
Okay. We don't have those.
No, not really.
Even when they put a course on the water, it's not...
I mean, you get something like a Kiawah ocean course, which would be similar to that.
But not... All right, I just
you have a lot of Lynx style here.
Glancing over your shoulder at the television set, McIlroy did bogey 11, so he is now minus one.
He's having issues with his irons.
I believe that by the end of today, you probably have to be
three or four.
Three or four. three or four to have a chance to win, to have a real chance to win. All right, we will take a break. Ann Hornaday will join us, and I'll explain the story of why Ann Hornaday is joining us when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is a band called Mandy Valentine. Jay Johnson, who plays bass and harmonica, sends us their songs. This is the newest single called Run Rabbit Run, and it's released today, July 21st. There's Missy Pigeon on vocals and guitar, Abby Heyer on vocals and tambourine, Delaney Keefe vocals and percussion, Sam Berduta lead guitar, Jay Johnson bass and harmonica, and Matty Clouser drums and engineering. Mandy Valentine will play a release show in Philadelphia. Listen to this place, at Kung Fu Necktie on July 23rd, so that's Sunday, with, and listen to this, Thelma and the Sleaze and Kelsey Cork and the Swigs. Who's doing this?
Kelsey Cork.
They're releasing a new album as well. Thelma and the Sleaze. Fantastic. Again, this is called Run Rabbit Run, and it plays in Ann Hornaday, and I should tell Ann and tell everybody that 3 or 4 days ago, I got a phone call and a couple of notes from my friend Lowell Singer in California, who said, you need to have Ann Hornaday on Friday because of the releases of Barbie and Oppenheimer. And then he sent me stuff that this has become, I don't know what a meme is, but a meme is something I should know. And it's become referred to as Barbenheimer. And Lowell was of the opinion, that I'm sure Ann is of the opinion as well, that these are going to be the two biggest movies of the summer. So, I mean, my first question to you would be, is indeed this true? Is there talk about these movies, and how are they linked together? They couldn't be more different. So how are they linked together?
Well, Lowell is correct. Thank you, Lowell. Yes, I mean, these are the hype surrounding especially Barbie, but the fact that they were released on the same day, and that, like you said, I mean, they are so completely different in palette and tone, but yet they are linked in terms of 20th century popular culture and history, right? I mean, these are huge, monumental. One's a doll, one's the atomic bomb, but right, they both in their ways shaped the 20th century, shaped our lives and expectations and aspirations and anxieties. So there's a really interesting chiming going on between the two of them, and I just think people were really taken with the idea that they were being released on the exact same day.
Again, they seem so completely different to me. It just seems so weirdly different. Did I read correctly that Mattel, which of course produces Barbie, Mattel is involved in this movie?
Oh, for sure, yeah, and this is really an example. Well, you and I talked about this back when Air came out. You know, the movie, the Ben Affleck movie about the Air Jordan, is that, you know, Hollywood is just constantly hoovering up and scraping the environment for any kind of existing intellectual property they can find that has a pre-sold audience. You know, that has awareness and loyalty built into it, and interest built into it. And now they're coming for the products themselves. So now it's the Air Jordan. Now it's the BlackBerry, and it's the Barbie doll, you know. And the Barbie doll is really a natural because it just has transgenerational appeal to especially girls and women, but a lot of men, right, too. And so, I mean, people, of all the movies coming out this year, this is the one people have asked me about the most in terms of, have you seen it yet? What's it like? You know, there's so much interest around this because people have such a deep personal relationship with that doll.
I don't, you know.
But I mean, I came into this thinking. Yeah.
No, I don't. I mean, I'm an only child. I don't have sister. You know what I mean? I never saw it. It's never in
exactly
my house.
It wasn't part of your zeitgeist.
No. So, but let me ask this. If I ran Mattel, I would not let some auteur go out and write a Barbie movie. I would not, right? I mean, Greta Gerwig, she's not some rum-dum.
No, she's going to bring edge. She's going to, you're right.
So I'm sort of surprised at that they allowed it. So.
I am too, and I'm impressed, frankly. And when you see this movie, it's banana. Like, this movie, like you said, Greta Gerwig's no slouch. And when you hire her, you know she's going to bring feminist critique to it.
Sure.
And she does. And she does it mostly delightfully. I mean, it's so much fun to watch. It is so funny. But it is pointed. And it is confrontational. And I really do respect Mattel for letting her have her vision, you know? It's like they really gave her the reins. And I don't know what those backroom executive suite conversations were like, but it feels to me like she got to make the movie she wanted to make. And I think that's fantastic.
I'd want total control. If I own this, I would want total control. And obviously you hire her, you don't have that. Now, I read your review of this movie. You didn't think it was a great movie. You liked it fine, but you didn't think it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have to be great to be an enormous hit?
No. Right. And already people seem to be responding really well to it. I mean, like, my question sort of going in and coming out was, who's the audience? And by that I mean, it's pink, it's fluffy, it's funny, it's adorable. It stars two really appealing actors, Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling. And I think on its face, I think a lot of parents might think, oh, good to take the daughter to, you know, and the young daughter, like between 8 and maybe 10 or 12. I'm not sure that age group is going to get as much out of this movie as grown-ups. I mean, it's very much geared toward people who grew up with the doll and now have a more a little bit more troubled or problematic, you know, understanding of what Barbie means in terms of expectations regarding women and what we should look like and what we should do in the world. So that, you know, that, but I do think that for that core, you know, for that adult audience who's a little bit more knowing, I don't want to say cynical, but, you know, maybe who aren't quite as, dewy-eyed about the whole thing, it really hits the sweet spot. I'm just not sure if it's going to appeal to the younger, you know, the younger part of the audience.
Let me go to the Oppenheimer movie.
Mm.
I can't believe there hasn't been a movie about J. Robert Oppenheimer to this point, right? I mean, look.
Well, God, it's so complicated, though, Tony. I mean, that story. It's,
right.
It's when you think about all the things you have to pack in there. It's almost like Barbie, you know, in terms of, like, all the things you have to address and sort of represent and pay, you know, give time to. It's a gnarly, complicated, many-layered story.
You love that movie.
I was so impressed by this movie. I mean, I just sort of feel like it's been so long since I've seen a movie of this scale and ambition and technical finesse that is not about a superhero or somebody flying around or doing crazy things. Or, I mean, this is a movie about an adult person doing adult things, about a really consequential period of our history. And it is, you know, look, it's three, you know, I'm constantly raging against long movies being too long. This is at 3 hours. It earns every single minute. I was engaged, absorbed. I mean, it's beautifully executed, and it's a fascinating story. He's a fascinating man. Cillian Murphy plays him exquisitely. Robert Downey Jr. is kind of his, you know, now I'm getting my Miserable references confused. Is that Jean Valjean or Javert? He's his Javert. He's kind of his nemesis, Louis Strauss. It's just beautifully done. I can't say enough about it, but it's like that movie. I kind of feel like it's the movie that you and I and our cohort have been waiting for. Like, oh, they can still do this. They can still make epic movies about serious substantive things that are thoroughly engaging and entertaining.
So here was my concern. Here is my concern. I don't know who wrote it. I haven't seen it. I know nothing about it. But I'm old enough to have studied this in high school and college, because it was incredibly important when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And my worry is that Oppenheimer and what he did will be viewed from a 2023 lens and not a 1944 lens.
Right. No. I would say, you know, people's mileage may differ, but I don't think that that happens in this movie. It was actually written by Christopher Nolan, you mm-hmm. know, the director. Mm-hmm. And he adapted Kai Bird and Walter Sherwin's book, American Prometheus. And I think he takes great pains. You know, the perspective is always Oppenheimer's, right? So this is his subjective story. And as we all know, he did develop doubts about the bomb. And not only did he develop doubts about the implications of it, but even people on his team at the Manhattan Project were ambivalent. So you see them having sort of rump meetings about, like, okay, where are we going here, you know? And is this, they called it the gadget, you know, is the gadget we're building going to destroy the world one day? And what are the moral implications of that? So the film engages of all of that, but I would say the film very much doesn't judge it, you know? I mean, the film really just shows his own ambivalence, but does not project any kind of presentism or presentist judgment.
Yeah,
on
that's
that. And I think that's one of its great, great strengths. It's very, very nuanced.
That becomes important to me. I mean, you know, it does.
Yeah, and this is where somebody like Nolan, I think, is right, because he's not a super emotional filmmaker, right? He's detached. That can be a criticism of his films. They're very technically perfect, but sometimes emotionally inert. But in this case, I think that detachment and that distance actually helps, because it helps solve that problem that you're anticipating.
See, I think about this. I found out within the last week, I actually found out from a cousin of mine that one of our relatives was involved in the Manhattan Project.
Oh, wow.
He was an engineer of sorts. And I said to my cousin, are you kidding me? Like, I'm this old and I'm
right.
finding this out now? And she said, well, it was all sort of secretive. And I said, no, it wasn't secretive in the 50s. No, it wasn't secretive. It was secretive when they were doing it. But now, I'm finding this out now, and I said, are you sure he was involved? And there is apparently some belief that, not that he held it in his hand, and not that he carried it out, but he might have been in Los Alamos. He
right.
might have actually been there. And so I was amazed by that. And I have, my trouble is, I think everybody's trouble, which is, I know that what was accomplished here was of great consequence. It may not be good. It may not be good. You unleash this stuff, it may not be good. But at the time, I understand why we were not doing this alone.
Mm-hmm.
We were racing against the people who were at war with us to do this.
Yeah.
So that you understand my great concern is...
Oh, no, they make that crystal clear.
Okay.
They make that crystal clear.
Yeah.
There are some arguments, and these are real arguments, which is Germany was already defeated. The argument was, would Japan have kept fighting, or were they on the brink of surrender?
Right.
That's kind of the little... But, you know, these are all worthwhile... But by no means do I feel that this movie judges, you know, like... I think it grapples with the moral implications, but I don't think it's moralistically judgmental.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I just think it's so sophisticated, and that's one of the reasons I loved it so much, is that I just think it threads that needle so elegantly. But mostly it's just I just want to emphasize what a superb viewing and aesthetic experience this is on every, you know, I wrote this book a few years ago about how to watch a movie, and I kind of took every craft area about, you know, how do you evaluate screenwriting and production design and cinematography, and it's just like, this is a movie that just aces every single one. I mean, it's just it's a pleasure, you know, to watch and to think about and to be, you know, it demands every bit of your attention. It's challenging, but it's just so rewarding because it just fulfills all of that, and just beautifully.
It's so weird to think that somebody will go see Oppenheimer one day and Barbie the next, and they will, right? They will.
Sure. Which I did, right, which is exactly what I did. I saw Barbie Monday night and Oppenheimer Tuesday night, and I was a really happy camper all week because I don't want to dismiss Barbie. You know, frankly, Barbie does the same thing with those craft. You know, it is a beautiful-looking movie. The production design and costumes and performances are just fabulous. And so... these are two really highly satisfying experiences, especially in a theater. So, Yeah, I'm really a happy, I'm a happy girl this week. It's great.
Thank you so much for being on. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
Ann Hornaday, boys and girls, we will take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the biggest story where we live, which is the apparent, and I don't want to say complete, I'm going to say the apparent sale of the Washington football team. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is a song called Top of the Ferris Wheel.
I ran as fast as I could.
This is sent to us by Lisa Jeanette, who says, I've been told I should submit music to your show, and I've done some listening to the podcast. I think my music might fit your audience. My music is all on major streaming services, and the song I think might be best is Top of the Ferris Wheel, which I've attached. Please let me know what you think. I think it's great.
Yeah, we like it very much.
And it has that Ferris Wheel feel with the piano chords at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely lovely. It's from Lisa Jeanette. It's from an album called Jellyfish on the Moon. You know, it's wonderful. Michael, if people like Lisa Jeanette want to send in their original songs, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonykornheiser.com.
And I'll just say, if Thelma and the Sleaze want to send us a song or two, we'd be interested in listening.
Thelma and the Sleaze. Wow, that's a wow.
We still have the promo code TKChange100 available at johnnyo.com, TKChange100. And the duration of Tony's plank is long enough to tell Helen the story of getting change for a hundo.
Right, yeah. Okay, so let me explain what we're going to do here and why we're going to do it. As you know from the last show that we had, I was interested in getting two different people to talk about two different things in soccer. I wanted to talk about the Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand, but I got sort of nervous because I don't know what time it is in Australia and New Zealand. And we talked about getting Julie Foudy, and then I realized I don't even know if Julie Foudy's there. And Julie Foudy lives in California, so I can't even get her to do this show because it's 5 in the morning.
Right.
You know, so we didn't do that. And so we decided we would try and get Taylor Twellman.
Yes.
Who's been on the show before and is really good.
Yeah, we like Taylor very much.
He was going to be in Washington, D.C. for the MLS All-Star Game. He broadcast it on Apple. I think he works for Apple. And we just couldn't. He wants to do it. We wanted to talk about Messi.
Yes.
I just wanted, because Messi's debut, even though it's an exhibition game, Messi's debut is tonight.
Yes.
In Miami.
It's a tough ticket.
Wanted to do it, but explain what happened.
We had some travel issues. I think he got stranded in Atlanta. And as we were talking last night, it was like, well, I think I'll be okay, but I might be in the air. And we weren't sure when he was going to know exactly.
So we had to.
So anytime there's uncertainty like that, you really can't go down that road.
Right.
But we'll get him on at some point.
No, well, we will, because he's really good.
Yes.
Okay, he's really good. He's a professional soccer player. Yeah. He's quite good. Should I read this thing from, let me just read this from Brian Hoffman before I get into what we're actually going to do. In April, you talked about receiving and eating great bagels from Adam Goldberg of Pop-Up Bagels.
Oh, yes.
At the time, I went to their website and saw that Pop-Up Bagels was soon to open a location at 177 Thompson Street in Manhattan. I know where that is. Less than a mile from my apartment, I immediately told my wife that we needed to try these bagels based upon your recommendation. As she often does when I reference your show, my wife either shrugged, rolled her eyes, or completely tuned me out. After weeks of bugging her, Memorial Day weekend, she finally agreed to take a walk with me to try the bagels. Manhattan is notoriously empty on Memorial Day weekend, so we walked into Pop-Up Bagels with no other customers inside. Adam threw me a salt bagel. I add parenthetically, the best salt bagel I've ever had, and asked me how I heard about the store. I told him the Tony Kornheiser show. Adam said he loved the show and thanked me for coming in. Since then, I've been back to the shop a few times and had to wait on a long line each time. My wife follows numerous food influencers on Instagram. Ask Michael. What is that?
Just someone who's going to show you a lot of cool spots to go try.
Okay. And has confirmed that Pop-Up Bagels is officially blowing up in the city. Apparently, everybody's now talking about it. And the other day, my wife begrudgingly told me that I was way ahead of the crowd on Pop-Up Bagels, all because of Tony. Validation.
That's the TK influence right there.
I feel good about that.
Yes.
Okay. So we had an open spot today And as luck would have it, and as good luck would have it, the most important sports story where I live in Washington, D.C., where Wilbon has a residence but doesn't live in Washington, D.C., is ongoing right now. It is the sale of the Washington football team from Daniel Snyder to a group of people led by Josh Harris. Daniel Snyder, born and raised in Washington, D.C. area. Josh Harris, born and raised in the Washington, D.C. area. Born and raised during the glorious times of Washington, when the Washington football team, which was then known by a word that I will not use on the air here, but which I think of them when I think of that period of time, had a hold on this city unlike any sports team in the country in any city, with the exception of the Denver Broncos. NFL cities, Denver and Washington. Why is Washington an NFL city? Well, they didn't have a baseball team for 30 years. If you cared about baseball, you had to go to Baltimore, which is fine, but it wasn't your team. Denver didn't have the baseball team. Colorado Rockies, there was no baseball team there. Basketball, hockey, yeah, okay. It's not the same. There was a story in the Washington Post about a month ago talking about the decline of the fan base of the Washington football team, the alarming decline of it through the stewardship and ownership of Dan Snyder. And said the next most popular team was the baseball team. Okay, I love baseball. I watch all the time. But that baseball team is for sale, and that baseball team is in last place. The next most popular team was the hockey team. Won the Stanley Cup. Okay, great. You know, people care. It was lovely when they won the Stanley Cup and there were watch parties all over the city. That team is old. It doesn't make the playoffs anymore. It's run through coaches in the last few years. And the Ovechkin era is ending. The next team was the basketball team that the Post said nobody cares about. The Wizards. Nobody cares about them at all. And they stink. And they're going to be worse this year and for a couple of years as they change their entire orientation to how they build a team. So my feeling is that the Washington football team is like dormant grass. It's still there. It's ready. It just needs a little light and a little water. And if Josh Harris can do that, and I think that means making the playoffs a couple of times in the next 3 or 4 years, and building a new stadium at RFK, which they are not necessarily inclined to do. There are stories in the paper today that, you know, they could go somewhere else. I think you got to go to RFK to recreate this. But Wilbon's position is it cannot be recreated. It's done. And he says his son, Maddie, 16 years old, has never been to Washington football game and roots for the Ravens. I don't dispute that Maddie roots for the Ravens. I dispute anyone roots for the Ravens in Washington. This is a football team here. This is not like the Orioles when there was no Nationals, when that was the only way to see baseball. There's a football team here. You may hate the owner, you may hate the team, but nobody's rooting for the Ravens when there's a football team here. I turned to my son, who was 5 years old when the Washington team won the Super Bowl for the last time in Minnesota, the bandwagon year. Greatest fun I ever had riding. Greatest fun, the bandwagon year.
Just waving goodbye to my dad.
You're
wondering if he'd ever come home.
Bring me back a half a soda.
You have never seen them any good.
Never seen them any good. And you just go a few years after that to the move to FedEx, which is really tied to the Snyder era. And unfortunately, yep, you inherit that behemoth of
but Jack
cement
Cook built
box.
It. Right.
Yeah, but
right,
that's
right.
I think that's the beginning of the end, because you never had any chance or any path to success there. And I think you're foolish to look at this town and think that kids did not grow up rooting for a very exciting Ravens team over the last 20 years. And I think you take a look at what it means to get success for this ownership group in the first couple years. I'm not even sure it's the playoffs. I think it's just a sense of comfort and being able to say you're a fan of the team again. I mean, we were hiding in the shadows,
yeah,
still struggling with our own internal questioning of, wow, when it gets to the witching hour, there's something about me that's rooting for this team. I shouldn't root for it. And you have to try and separate the on-field lack of success and mistakes, the sort of professional mistakes, versus the workplace, the toxic culture issues that are also very troubling and linked to that. But you forget the team's actually made the playoffs more times than you're going to be able to remember over these last 5, 6, 7 years. They just get bounced by any other team in that wild card game. So I think it needs to come back to the city. You look at the glory days of the team and realize there is a path to ownership over a fan base that stretched well south of Washington, D.C. As you went down the I-95 corridor and you had people taking trains in, big bus trips in. This is before other expansion teams. And you had people who looked at this as their team. And the that market has shriveled up. If you go to the stadium, which I've not been to in years, but even as you go around the general area, you realize the team has definitely shifted from a Washington, D.C. and inner Maryland team to much more of an expanded Northern Virginia fan base. And you have to struggle. What does that mean in terms of the demographics of the city, of the immediate market? This goes back to how the team was operating in terms of not wanting to integrate and what that meant towards, you know, fans of the area who did not want to root for the team.
Okay. And we will quibble on the Raven stuff, and I will just say this. I have lived here for almost 45 years. I don't live 30 miles away, 300 miles away, 3,000 miles away. I'm not sure those people know what they're talking about when they talk about this team. I have lived here, and I think I sort of understand it. I am recognized on the street all the time. Of course I am. And I talk to people who do things like pick up the garbage once a week, or people who stop in the middle of the road and yell out to me. And the first thing they talk about is always the PTI show. And the second thing is always the football team. They hate the football team. They hate the owner. But they want it to be great again. They are eager for this change. They are eager. There's no other team in this city that they are eager for. It's the football team, because their identity in sports was forged by the football team. I know Dan Snyder a little bit. I knew him a little bit better when he bought the team. He's 15 years younger than I am, I think. He got the team because the league did not want the Milstein brothers to have the team, and he was a minority investor, and suddenly it fell in his lap, and I think he was in his 30s when it fell in his lap. At the start, he spent all the money he had. He may have spent it unwisely by bringing in Deion Sanders and Steve Spurrier.
Jeff George.
Yeah, I mean, he may have spent it unwisely, but he wanted them to win very desperately, and he was not the ogre that he is now by any means. He was too young. He was a fan. It was sort of different. I think the worst thing he ever did was fire Norv Turner.
They were 7-6.
I just don't think that was the right thing to do, and it got progressively worse. And he made hires. He made bad – like Steve Spurrier is a great college coach. He wasn't a good pro coach. Joe Gibbs, a second time around, was involved in auto racing. He couldn't devote himself to this. Jim Zorn had no business being a head coach. Jay Gruden, you know, no, it doesn't work. Ron Rivera is a legitimate coach. They have no squad now, and it just went down. And all of the things that happened, all of the accusations about Snyder, all of these things in combination made him, in fact, a pariah. A total pariah. There were celebrations yesterday that this deal is going to go through. Now, I have that great fear that since he owns 100% of the team, at some point he'll say, I don't know. Maybe I want this instead of that. I don't know. But it is a good thing for sports in Washington to get a new owner. I am not jaded to the point where I say it's bad to have somebody who grew up here, because the last guy grew up here and it was no good. It was no good.
Yeah.
It didn't work, but I'm optimistic about the next guy. Are you?
I am. I think it's interesting if you look at the path of the Broncos sale and this one when it goes through as to what those two teams have meant to you. But I think this looks like a much more professional operation. But in terms of the valuation, as what the increase was for this team, even based on the Denver sale, which seemed like it happened just yesterday.
Just such a lot of money. It's a third higher.
Yeah.
$6 billion.
Yeah.
Wow. $6 billion.
Yeah, that's a lot of change.
I mean, I wonder, that's great for the league. So I wonder if the league will do things for this team and this ownership group that they wouldn't do for anybody else.
Oh, I would.
To thank them.
Yeah, I would think that they'll be a little bit more amenable to, you know, helping them out. especially when you find out that they withheld $11 million under Snyder, you know, that all that came out in the report where they fined him $60 million. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't touch him at all on a $6 billion deal. But $60 million is what, 1/100th of it? It's 1%.
Yeah.
As long as there are no sewage spills anymore, I think people will be pretty happy.
That's the first thing. They've got to have a new stadium. You have to have a new stadium, but you immediately need to do repairs on the initial stadium, you know, and get that up to code. Now, I don't know if you heard about this. I guess there was a big sort of celebration down at the bullpen.
I saw it because Jimmy Crilly's son was there, and okay. He sent me a picture.
Well, I was monitoring Kip on social media, among other people, and I guess...
Was he down there?
Yes, I think he was. Oh. And I think Harris called in to somebody's show and then bought a round for down there. So it's at least an initial... I know it's the honeymoon phase, but that's a nice
gesture. Well, even think about the location on there. That's why everyone started to go to the XFL games, because they're like, no way am I going to FedEx Field.
Nah. Yeah, you don't want to go down there.
They've got to build a new stadium.
They have to.
You know,
but there's also,
that has to be expedited.
There's lots of things, as you said.
That's going to take years, though.
And the D.C. City Council isn't exactly welcoming them with open arms.
Anybody on the D.C. City Council who does not want the stadium in RFK should be voted on a recall, voted out of office.
Maybe get right. People
Phil,
taking
I read
the
that
metro
Phil Mendelson doesn't want it.
Yeah, Phil Mendelson, not a big fan of that. Yeah,
well, get out.
Yeah, it would be right. So great for the city.
Yeah, so anyway. All right, email and jingle when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Sounds like the big Hammond, doesn't it? When they used to play at ball games. That's a good pitcher. Pennsylvania's own. Just wonderful. You want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad, please?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you. Then pop on in and you will be thrilled.
Often, most often, Nigel gives me song lyrics before we get into the mailbag. This is from a movie. It's very easy. Shut up, John Big Booty, you coward. You are the weakest individual I ever know. Now, he then screams, Big Booty. This is from The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. If you haven't seen it, I don't know if you'll like it. I was in my 30s when I saw it. I just loved it. John Lithgow. It's his first big movie, I think.
Yes, as Emilio Lozado, I think.
Yeah. Or, Big Booty.
John Wharton.
Big Booty. John Wharton. It's crazy. It makes no sense.
Right, but it's thoroughly fun. Yes.
Thanks to today's guest, Ann Hornaday. Thanks to today's sponsors, Policy Genius, Trade Coffee, and Simply Safe. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. Get the show through Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a review. Let me do this as an announcement. This comes from Bob Walsh in Wethersfield, Connecticut. This is about the Summer Littles. The first Saturday in August is almost upon us, which means that Littles will soon be gathering across the U.S. and Canada for Summer of Littles 5, a celebration of the connective tissue. This year there are 39 venues. Particularly notable among these are Lewistown, Pennsylvania, at Shy Bear Brewery, where Summer of Littles Wheat Ale, first sold at Calvert Woodley, will be on tap.
Wow.
And Minneapolis, Minnesota, where co-host Hot Pink Hangover will put on its reunion show to be live streamed for all the Littles and Hotties who can't make it to the Twin Cities. Wow, the reunion show kicks off at 8 p.m. Eastern, so you can watch a couple of numbers before bedtime, provided Michael will help you with live stream. Please exhort the Littles not to let August 5th sneak up on them. Folks should visit summeroflittles.com to check out venues near them and RSVP for the opportunity to meet other Littles in their locale. Littles who cannot attend an in-person venue may RSVP for the virtual venue, a Zoom call, which will connect Littles around the globe. Summer of Littles 5 is on August 5th, which makes sense. It's in a couple of weeks. Frequent emailer Lee Gordon put it best, finally, August has a holiday. So we do that. From Andrew Kent. Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon is an overseas French territory just off the east coast of Canada. So the European golf cruise you're looking for may be closer than you think. You could even depart from New York, so no flying would be required. When you visit Cape Breton, on your way, you would play three of the top six golf courses in Canada, including Cabot Cliffs. Hop on the Google machine and take a peek. You won't find a more beautiful golf course in the world. We promise fantastic seafood, excellent wine, and kind people who have no idea who you are. That actually sounds good, doesn't it?
That sounds great.
That perfect. Really sounds good.
Yeah.
I called a company that specializes in these cruises, and they're sending me hard copy. They're sending me where they go and what they do. Yeah,
you're never going to get off of this list.
I'm excited about that. From Matt Schrader, who's a professional travel advisor. He says, as you can tell from my signature below, I work as a travel advisor. If you'd like to get some options for a river cruise, let me know. I don't charge a fee. You only pay for your trip, nothing extra. Can I be the official travel advisor of the Tony Kornheiser Show?
I would say yes, but
do
Philip,
we have one already?
Well, Philip and Elizabeth Jennings are the people
that we generally refer
from
the Americans.
Yes.
Yeah. From Jeff Jasper in Overland Park, Kansas. Dear Dr. Tony, we're taking a cruise to Hawaii in November. We hope to return to San Diego on the same boat in December. We will have lots of days at sea with no land at sight. At least we will avoid those awkward conversations with relatives at the Thanksgiving table. From Tim Crick in Fort Collins, Colorado. You know the best part of the Hallmark Channel Christmas cruise? The cruises are all exactly the same, just like the movies. So if you've cruised one, you've cruised them all. From Brandon Borzelli in Lebanon, New Jersey. While the idea of taking short boat trips with frequent stops up and down a river might sound appealing, the adventure of Huck Finn comes to mind. These riverboats could easily involve robbery, swindling, identity theft, blood feuds, conspiracy to commit murder, and actual murder. You could end up fleeing into the wild to avoid it, or in your case, fleeing to avoid getting locked up in a home. When you factor in food poisoning, your best bet might be to skip the river cruise and head straight to the river dance. Michael Flatley and hundreds of dancing feet. Not only are you not on a boat, but you're in and out in an evening, and I hear they validate parking. From Hugh Gannon in Harwich, Massachusetts. Is it Harwick or
Harwich, yes.
Harwich,
you got that right, yes.
Shohei is good at baseball. Tony is pessimistic. Water is wet. These are the top revelations of the week. From Adam Benson in St. John's in Newfoundland. In regards to the episode titled Tony is Pessimistic, to be fair, the name of the podcast could be Tony is Pessimistic.
That's a fair point, yes.
From Chris Ratt in Tiarno, New Zealand. Interesting to hear TK on PTI recently suggest he could complete three or four press-ups or push-ups, which raises the question of a planking update. It's been ages since we heard how long the plank lasts now. I'm happy to be the official correspondent of the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup in New Zealand and Australia, especially as I'm attending a game in Dunedin, I hope it's pronounced, or maybe Dunedin, New Zealand. There's a city in Florida, which I think is pronounced Dunedin. My first report is that New Zealand have won their first ever Women's World Cup match, beating Norway 1-0. Yes, that was yesterday.
That's right.
Yes, I sent Saliza a Facebook friend request, and given he hasn't responded, tell him to eat it. Yeah, Chris Ratt in New Zealand. Planking update, I'm up to about 5 minutes.
Wow.
I'm up to about five now. You know,
I've
held him later today. We'll see if I can go. I don't feel it today, though. From Tom Mule, the official solstice, sunrise, and sunset monitor for the Tony Kornheiser Show. After hearing about your sadness with the decrease in daylight again today,
yeah.
Especially with thunderstorms last night, waking me up at 3.
Yeah, very dark this morning.
After hearing about your sadness with the decrease in daylight due to the changes in the sunrise and sunset, just wondering if you'd like to upgrade your solstice, sunrise, and sunset monitoring subscription to our monthly or weekly plan. So you don't have to call our operators. I can send Michael the link.
That's brilliant.
From Cameron Stevens in Sydney, Australia, to the Northern Hemisphere, eat it. Sincerely, the Southern Hemisphere. From Josh Packard in Greeley, Colorado. I can't figure out what you have against Louise Gluck when you both have so much in common. Below is an almost verbatim transcript for your Wednesday show turned into a poem in the style of Miss Gluck that I'm titling An Ode to Summer Past in July. In late May and June and early July, when I got up, there was not just light in the sky, it was bright. At 5:45, 6 in the morning, it was bright. 5:30, it was bright. 5:15, sometimes it was light. Not now. No. We're into late July, and the answer is not now. Today was a gloomy, rainy day, and you can tell. You can tell at night that it's getting darker earlier. Then around the time of the summer solstice, and we're headed into that time when you lose not just seconds, but minutes in the morning and in the evening. And I don't like that. I don't like that. This is the long march towards the great darkness of winter. This is the most brilliant email we've ever had. It is.
I don't like that.
Now, kids, compare and contrast the poets Kornheiser and Gluck.
And from Jeff Barger, or Jeff Barger in Hillsborough, North Carolina. "I Can't Get Away From Me" should be the signature song of the La Chiserie musical that I hope will be created in the new future. Other song titles could include Wilbon's Midwest and Life is a Sand Trap. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
But I still need a bit of milk, full fat, which I've warmed in the microwave.
I could down to the storefront corner, peeking over the rows, hoping to see the promise of the Ferris wheel, part of the sphere, winking back at me from the sky. I could see colors, the lights all aglow. Oh, how they twinkle at night. It's time for the carnival. Can I go? Hop a ride on the merry-go-round. Let's glide to the top of the Ferris wheel. I can see everything better from here. Didn't have much to hope for. Never dreamed of diamonds or rubies. Came by the crazy, honestly. Learned how to act sane from the movies. Ah, you should have seen me back then. I was drunk with desire. I wanted to be good at something. Good to someone. Prove them all to be liars. It's time for the carnival. Can I go? Hop a ride on the merry-go-round. Let's glide to the top of the Ferris wheel. I can see everything better from here. I sit on the bench in Cape May. October lies mute on the shore. The church is a junkie's playground. The Connies don't stop there no more. Yes, it's a bit chilly in autumn, but I'm still seeking thrills and I have the right. No one should hold that against me. Everyone deserves to see pretty lights. It's time for the carnival. Can I go? Hop a ride on the merry-go-round. Let's glide to the top of the Ferris wheel. Doesn't matter how fast you go, go fast or slow as you might. All of life is a circle, catch as you can, don't hold on too tight. Just when you think you've gone forward, you might go backward again. Don't waste your time counting accomplishments if you can't count on your friends. It's time for the carnival. Can I go? Hop a ride on the merry-go-round. Let's glide to the top of the Ferris wheel. I can see everything better from here.